This is Gamerverse, all things gaming, geeky, and good. Welcome to Gamerverse. I'm your host, Erica, and I'm here to continue with the History of Video Game series. In part two, I'll be highlighting Nintendo, as it is both the predecessor of Atari and the reason that gamers had faith in the industry again. When we last left off, Atari was on its way out, and we were reaching a huge milestone year of 1985, which was the North American release of the Nintendo Entertainment System, the NES. You might remember that Atari and Nintendo both had 8-bit systems, but this is where power and processing made a huge difference. That blob, stick figure, or geometric shape could now look like an actual person, have color distinctions, clothing, and more. The worlds were more vibrant and richer thanks to these enhanced colors that were now possible. And the debut release of the Nintendo Entertainment System was the Mega Bundle that included the gun for Duck Hunt and Robbie the Robot. It came with a freaking robot. How was anybody going to compete with that, let alone resist it, no matter how burned they might still be feeling from Atari and Television and ColecoVision? Nintendo came out as a driving force in North America, even though we here weren't really yet familiar with the company. And Nintendo didn't come out of nowhere. It was operating in Japan since 1889. It was already big in Japan. Obviously, they were not making game consoles at this time. And Miyamoto was almost 100 years away from Donkey Kong. So, what were they making? And that would be the answer to last episode's trivia question. What was Nintendo making before video games? They made playing cards. Not playing cards the way that Western market might understand it, but kind of a special type of playing card called the Hanafuda card. In 1889, these cards were handmade and painted onto mulberry tree bark. It took a short time for the cards to catch on at first, but similarly to the classic 52 set of cards we might be used to, Hanafuda cards could be used to play a huge variety of games. Apparently, some of the popularity of these cards might be attributed to the Yakuza using them for gambling, but whatever the reason was, card games became extremely popular in Japan, and this started the rise of Nintendo. They changed these cards to plastic somewhere about 1959, and then became incredibly big when they got the license to produce Disney characters on those cards. This success of the cards, as well as the 600,000 copies of a book Nintendo created with new games to play with these cards, made Nintendo a complete market dominator and started to propel it to the giant that it is today. It also afforded them a little bit of luxury to start experimenting into other entertainment streams. But at the same time, this is where the Nintendo story starts to run a little parallel to the Atari one, when there was a market burst and suddenly people were not buying cards anymore. It was lucky that Nintendo was pursuing other venues, but they didn't enter the video game market in the way you might expect. If you remember from part one in the series, the first home console was the Magnavox Odyssey, and that was the 12 games in one, the one that basically was Pong, but, you know, it had the fun Mylars that you overlaid on your TV. Nintendo had actually approached Magnavox and worked out the rights to be the Odyssey's distributor in Japan in 1972. They saw the instant popularity and were determined to get into this market more directly. They were doing this through games initially. They released a game called the EVR Race in 1975 and quickly followed it up with the phenomenon that would be Donkey Kong. But these were only available for arcade, Atari, and other gaming devices. So Nintendo really got its start in content development, not console development. With characters such as Donkey Kong becoming a huge success, they kept pushing themselves to go further into the market. There was even an early prototype for a Game Boy invented called the Game & Watch. Nintendo's very first self-made console was the Famicom, which stood for Family Computer, and was released in 1983. So you might be thinking to yourself that we are now only 2 years away from the NES. This must have been the same system. Well, no. And yes, the Famicom unfortunately had a chip defect that caused machines to freeze and other problems, which resulted in about 500,000 recalled units. This was devastating to Nintendo. It was also around about the time that Nintendo reached out to Atari to possibly talk about working on something together. But for those of you keeping track at home, we are now in 1983, and we know what's about to happen next. As a fun what if, it might have been interesting had Nintendo contacted Atari even 1 year sooner, how all of this could have turned out. Nintendo was one of the few game makers that actually managed to survive 1984. But a lot of that was due to Nintendo's size and foothold in Japan. When everything came out on the other side, almost all their competitors were either gone or picked up by larger entertainment companies for extremely cheap. But Nintendo pressed on. In 1985, Nintendo had the worldwide release of their second go at their Famicom system. They fixed its original bugs, upgraded a few things, and put it into the small gray box we all know and love now. And of course, they renamed the system the Nintendo Entertainment System. There were definitely a lot of lessons to learn from the video game crash, and Nintendo was determined not to repeat the past. So they severely limited the number of third-party content development that could be released each year for their console. At this time, the idea of renting games was only just starting, so most kids had to wait patiently for their next birthday or Christmas, or pray that a friend or neighbor kid got the game so that you got a chance to play it. Some of us were a little luckier. Since I happened to live in Toronto, I had a Chinese hookup, so I could get those crazy 20 games in one cartridges every once in a while to play that were being bootlegged out of China. And 1985 was also the release of the Super Mario Brothers. This game did not come with the original NES release, as many people think, and there really is a specific reason for that. As we talked about, consumers had been burned pretty bad with the video game crash in 1984, but retailers were definitely hit hardest, so most didn't want to take a chance on any new game consoles. The very first console that came out was the Super Bundle for this reason, with the gun for Duck Hunt and the robot for Gyromite. As a small aside, I don't know about you guys, but I had Robbie the Robot for Gyromite, and honestly, it was cute and looked cool, but it was really fairly useless. You'd never pass a level of Gyromite if you waited for this thing. You needed that second player to hit the A and B buttons at the right time to be able to play the game. At least that's the way it was for me as a kid. If you've never seen Robbie and what it does, he picks up one of his two spinning discs and places them down essentially as a weight to press down on an A or B button on the second controller. So you're waiting for this robot to pick up a disc, let it spin, slowly move it to the side, painfully slowly lower it down onto a button, and hopefully by this time you haven't died or haven't been squashed, because it has to do with these lift systems. If you beat the game using the actual robot, you have some incredible patience. So my favorite part of the Super Bundle, and a subject of many a tournaments in my house, was Duck Hunt. We went crazy for that game. It became a contest between me and my brother who could shoot the farthest away from the TV, but of course the cord is only so long. We're not idiots though, so once we maxed out that range, we'd pull the NES console as far as its cable would allow, and then you have a whole new level of competition. And before I continue any history of Nintendo, I just have to say this. How many of you really wish you could shoot that Duck Hunt dog when he laughs at you? I remember wasting precious bullets in the game knowing it would do nothing, but it kind of made me feel better. This system was a huge investment, but people were happily willing to make it. So I think we need to talk about what Nintendo was bringing that made them fall instantly in love with the system and its titles. Nintendo was all about story, and especially character, and they nailed it. All you have to say is Mario, and right there, you know him, you love him, you probably have a favorite Mario game, you've got your favorite character or bad guy from one of the worlds, and you all have your favorite driver in Mario Grand Prix. Since Mario is just so synonymous with the word Nintendo, that got me thinking about how much I used to love playing the Super Mario Brothers games growing up, particularly number 3. But I don't think I actually knew what any of the stories behind the games were. So I went back and looked up the first 3 stories, and I'm going to share them with you now because some of it I knew and some of it I had no clue. And they might surprise you just a little bit. Let's start off with the Super Mario Brothers number 1 plotline. The Mushroom Kingdom is invaded by the Koopa, a tribe of dark magic-using turtles. Their magic changes all the townsfolk in the Mushroom Kingdom into inanimate objects such as rocks, plants, and bricks. Only Princess Toadstool, the Mushroom King's daughter, can break the spell and put the kingdom back together again. But she's been captured by King Koopa himself, so Mario sets off to rescue her. For some reason. Can we just pause here? Just to ask why Mario is doing all of this. It's sort of like Link from Legend of Zelda. They both have princesses that are being kidnapped and having to go through the most ridiculous and bizarre places to rescue them. And I can't help but go back to that townsfolk being turned into bricks thing. The entire Mario Brothers world is full of these bricks. Should I feel bad then when I'm smashing Mario's head into them? And doesn't that raise some weird questions about why mushrooms, flowers, and stars come out of them? Doesn't that also really change your perspective on what a free man is when you break a brick? Okay, this is just too surreal a line of thinking. Let's get back to saving some princesses for whatever the reason was. In the first Mario, you can play Mario or Luigi, and you can go from being small, super, which basically just means full grown, fire, where you shoot fireballs out in front of you, or invincible temporarily if you get a star. I would say that this Super Mario Brothers actually has a fairly straightforward plotline. You might have noticed that there's a lot of parallels between Mario 1 and The Legend of Zelda, and this wasn't exactly accidental. They were being worked on at the same time by almost the exact same creative team, and they did borrow elements from each other's games. To be fair though, they were both extremely well loved for their own merits. Let's look now at Super Mario Bros. 2. This was the second North American game in the series, but there were other Mario games between this released in Japan. Apparently, they were deemed too hard for the North American market and were never actually released here. So Super Mario Bros. 2 has an incredibly weird plotline. I'm going to read it to you exactly how it appears in the instruction book. One night, Mario has a strange dream, and he finds himself climbing a long staircase leading up to a mysterious door. Opening up the door, Mario's eyes fell upon the incredible world unlike anything he'd ever seen. A quiet voice spoke to Mario, saying, "Welcome to Subcon, the land of dreams. Our once beautiful land suffers at the hands of the evil Wart. Only you can save us from his tyranny. Oh, and remember one thing, Wart hates vegetables." However, before Mario could figure out what was happening, he suddenly woke up in his bed and realized it was all a dream. The next day, while heading out to a picnic with his friends Luigi, Princess Toadstool, and Toad, Mario told the story of his strange dream. Hearing this was quite a shock to his friends, who all had the very same dream the night before. Upon arriving at their picnic spot, the group noticed a small cave. Inside was a long staircase that led up to a door. At the top, the four friends opened the door and stood shocked by what they saw. It was Subcon, the world of their dreams. Okay, this game literally ends with, "and then they woke up." I'm pretty sure I got in trouble once in school for writing an ending just like that. But with all the weird things happening in the game, it kind of makes more sense that it's a dream. It took me a few seconds to realize that Subcon was subconscious. And considering one of the major weapons you use against the baddies is turnips, it really would only make sense as a dream. Okay, but I have to ask, if Wart is afraid of vegetables, why weren't there more vegetables in the game? It was really just different shaped root vegetables. What was really fun about Super Mario Bros. 2 was that you could play four different characters. You could be Mario, Luigi, Princess Toadstool, or Toad. Anyone who's played this game knows that the best character to use was Princess Toadstool. For some reason, she could hover slash float over things when she jumped. Presumably, this has something to do with her dress, is my guess. The absolute worst person to play was Luigi. We called him Twinkle Toes at my house because when he jumped, his legs would just never stop moving, making his landings always off or a little harder than they really should be to line up. Mario was the best character after the princess, and Toad came in third. To be a little bit fair to the creators, it wasn't completely "and then they woke up." They threw in a "did it really happen or did it not?" which maybe is a tiny bit better. And that now brings us to Super Mario Bros. 3. Peach. Peace has returned to the Mushroom Kingdom thanks to Mario and Luigi. But Bowser, who got a name now for this one, sent his 7 children, Larry, Morton, Wendy, Iggy, Roy, Remy, and Ludwig, all to the other countries of the Mushroom World. The Mushroom Kingdom is apparently a gateway to all the other kingdoms. The Koopalings have stolen the 7 wands of the other kingdoms and transformed the kings into helpless, albeit kind of cute, animals. As a silly aside, I always like to bounce around the throne rooms when the toadstools are trying to explain things to you because it forces them to keep turning back and forth. I guess I'm just really easily amused. Luigi and Mario vow to go off and save the world. Or worlds. But while Mario and Luigi are beating up all of Bowser's kids, he runs off to steal Princess Toadstool and take her to his lair, or in Mario 3 speak, World 8. Each of the worlds that the player beats means that the wand is returned to that king and the kingdom goes back to normal. So this kind of becomes your primary quest throughout the game. There really is something you need to remember about the NES that we take for granted these days. There was no save button. And unless you had a TV in your house you could dedicate to leaving a system on, you either had to marathon your play or use the warp whistles. Using these whistles, you could go to the end of the game incredibly quick. Basically, you collect the 2 secret whistles in World 1, get 1 more in World 2, and you have everything you need to reach Bowser's lair in World 8. Or simply warp back to the level that you last left off at. The downside is you wouldn't have any of your rows of items to use or the monster number of free lives that you probably accumulated by that point, but at least you didn't have to keep replaying the same levels all the time. What was really cool and special about the culture that grew up around Nintendo was that the way to learn all these Easter eggs and secrets throughout the games, and in particular Mario 3, for example, had a ton of them, we all kind of taught each other. It was like kids passing it on to other kids. It's the kind of thing you talked about at school and then tried it when you got home or had a kid over to your house to show you. Except for the few kids that subscribed to the Nintendo Power magazine that had these secrets sometimes written in it, you didn't have the internet and you didn't have these other ways of finding out other than sharing directly player to player. You felt clever when you knew that you could get behind the screen in a level, or knowing where there's hidden objects and doors off screen that you have to run or fly to. It was a really cool part of what that system and the games meant to, well, to me in particular, and I'm hoping most of you shared a similar experience. As a much more recent development in the Super Mario 3 story, in September of 2015, Miyamoto, the creator himself, confirmed a fan theory that the entire Mario Bros. 3 game is a play being performed. That's why there is a large red curtain that goes up and all the players appear together on the stage. Though it still just looks like a tiled floor to me. If you didn't like the Mario 2 and then they woke up, just kind of ignore what I just said in the past minute because I don't think it really changes the way any of us saw the game. I'm sure you all had a favorite Mario 3 level. Please feel free to share yours in the comment section. Mine was definitely World 4, where everything was awesomely oversized. And I also really like the sort of glitch in World 5. If you're not sure what I mean, World 5 is a very short level. You go very quickly to World 6. But it's the only place that you can get a Tanuki suit, which is kind of like an adorable raccoon suit for Mario. And it's better than a leaf because you can turn into a stone statue for some reason. If you keep dying in this world and restarting, you get to get row upon row of Tanuki suits if you keep going to the Mushroom House. It'll obviously take forever, but if you have a summer afternoon to waste, it was kind of awesome. I think a huge lesson that Nintendo taught the video game market is that player experience is everything, and living out that virtual experience kind of became the primary objective of video games in general at this time and especially moving forward. Games needed more space, more power, more speed, and consoles needed to keep up. The worlds went from side-scrolling to 3D mapping. Games now have full novel-like backstories and animated cutscenes that look like mini-movies. This huge push and advancement will be a little easier to understand in the History of Video Games Part 3 when we look at the PlayStation and Xbox wars. This is where video games take a huge leap, getting us closer to where we are today. And of course, we'll be starting with PlayStation and the PS1. And I'm gonna throw a little Sega in there too. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Game Reverse Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at Game Reverse Cast, and you can follow me personally, Erica, at Frenemy Games, and get an insider's glimpse into my tabletop game designing adventures. Please leave us a review on iTunes and show us a little love, and maybe help other fantastic geeks like yourself find us. If you're interested in helping the podcast to keep going, please support our Patreon at patreon.com/GameReversePodcast. If you've got any episode ideas or inspirations, you can email us at thegamereversepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, gamers, this is Game Reverse, all things gaming, geeky, and good.